You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White, in for Beth React today. California loves beer. I mean, there's just no arguing that. The California Craft Brewers Association says there are more than 900 breweries in the state, supporting more than 49,000 jobs. More than 90% of Californians live within 10 miles of a brewery. McGeorge School of Law now offers the very first craft brewing class in a U.S. law school. And joining us today is the man teaching that class, Professor Daniel Croxall. Dan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to have you here. I worked in the beer industry before I got into journalism, and I had a good 10 years in that, back when we called them microbreweries.
Right.
Now it's craft breweries, and you and I agree maybe we should go back to microbreweries.
Definitely.
So, being a law school, the course is focused on California beer law, I would imagine, right?
Correct, yes. We focus on what it takes to get open, what it takes once a brewery is open, and the complexities of California regulations.
It's far more complicated than people might think.
Yeah, it really is. It's a really cool little niche area that has really wide-ranging arms. It has issues of constitutional law, trademark and intellectual property law, employment law. So when I meet lawyers or sometimes other professors and they're like, what do you teach? And I say craft beer law, they look at me like I'm teaching, you know, wiffle ball law or something. But it's actually a really much larger subject matter than people might think. And 2017, you know, it was a $76 billion contributor to the U.S. economy. So you add up those B's and that's real money at some point.
And Dan, the laws are constantly changing, too, as they are with everything. But, you know, if you go back several decades, you weren't allowed to do exactly what people are celebrating now. You know, here in Sacramento, we really celebrate the local craft beer scene. That wouldn't even have been legally possible back in, what, like the 70s?
Right. And that's, you know, if you go back to early regulation, it was what they called a strict three-tier system. And that meant that retailers, wholesalers, and manufacturers could have really basically nothing to do with each other. And that has changed somewhat and actually changed in California to really, I think, help craft breweries.
And what would you say is a law that most people just don't even think about when they think about, oh, I'd love to open up a craft brewery, or when they go in and order a beer from, you know, a local brewer? What is it that they're just not even seeing?
So I think in California we have self-distribution, which is really helpful for a small brewer. If you think about it, a lot of states don't allow self-distribution. If you make beer here in California, you can legally distribute it to your retail accounts. And what a lot of people don't realize is that it costs money to have a wholesaler involved. So that's almost, generally a 30% off the top. So if you're trying to open up a brand new brewery, it really helps to be able to take and deliver that to your own account without that 30% off the top. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. It's not as strict as you might see in other states, and that has allowed breweries to start without that initial, basic 30% hit.
And there's a lot of competition for each tap handle. And depending on which distributor you go with, or if you're distributing your own, mm-hmm. how do you get into that popular bar to make sure that your beer's on that handle?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. It's a lot about who you know. The only client I still have is my brother's brewery, El Segundo Brewing Company. And his partner's name is Tom. Tom knows everybody in LA beer. And if Tom walks into a bar and says, hey, I got this new thing, people are going to listen. So it really is who you know and personal relationships. And that's another area where it's very complicated in the law, is that they have these laws called Tide House laws.
I was going to ask you about the Tide. Those are a huge deal. When I just went to the Craft Brewers Summit, mm-hmm. I asked them what's an area of focus that everyone's talking about right now. Mm-hmm. And they told me, you're in good territory if you get into the Tide House area.
Right. That's actually where I'm focusing my scholarship. I just published a law review article on that and working on another one. So what Tide House is it's the regulations between it, what I'm looking at is the regulations between manufacturers and retailers. It also includes some wholesalers. But what it really is the common example is you cannot give, if you're a manufacturer, you can't give a retailer a thing of value. And that's the term, a thing of value. And that gets kind of complicated because the common example is that if you post a social media, like a tweet or a Facebook, if you're a manufacturer and you mention a retailer, you could be in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The ABC considers that a thing of value because it's a free advertisement, basically. So there is now an exception, and there are a ton of exceptions to these Tide House rules, which make it complicated. But there is an exception that if you're a manufacturer, you can mention a retailer as long as you mention two and you don't post the price. So those kinds of laws, California is tending to move in that direction. To say that California is helpful is that might be a little bit of a stretch, but when compared to other states, California really is ahead of the game.
So whether you're Budweiser, AB InBev, or your device brewing company, you cannot walk into a corner market and say, you know, I'd like my beer here, and here are some glasses to go along with it.
You're probably talking about the new bill that was just vetoed.
That was vetoed by Governor Brown.
That's right, AB 2573.
Yeah, saying he vetoed it. It would have allowed breweries to give away glasses to bars and other beer-selling outlets, saying it would have given an unfair advantage to big breweries with deep pockets.
I think that's absolutely correct.
And so he did that on the opening day of the Craft Brewers Summit. You think there was a connection there?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that I had fun walking around telling my friends in the industry, hey, the glassware bill was vetoed and nobody knew yet, so I got to be a newsbreaker. That was kind of cool.
So Tide House laws are at their core all about marketing, what you can and cannot do?
At least in this particular Rule 106, we call it, is the advertising. So it makes it basically to try to get rid of pay to play, right? So big giant breweries with deep pockets can afford to pay to play, essentially. That's really illegal, except for very small little exceptions that are in the rules. But if, you know, big brewery wants to come in and say, hey, we'll pay you $50,000 a year for advertising, in air quotes, you know, who's going to regulate that? And Device, one of my favorite breweries, can't, you know, might not be able to go and keep up with that kind of, you know, pay-to-play type strategy. So the Tide House laws are basically meant to not allow that kind of integration.
Is there a fun story behind the term Tide House? How did that come to be?
That's a good question. So Tide House is alcohol manufacturers back in the day, and I'll use saloons as an example. A manufacturer might make a ton of whiskey, and that manufacturer might then buy a bar. And then they would push that bar to sell as much of their own whiskey as they possibly can.
Of course, right.
Right. And so the state, and after it became legal to manufacture and sell alcohol again, the states generally held or found that that's not good for temperance concerns. It's not good for vertical and horizontal integration concerns or consumer choice. So a Tide House is one that is beholden in some way, a retailer who is beholden in some way to a manufacturer.
So literally a product that's tied to the house.
Yes, like, that's what
know.
It is. Yeah.
It's
funny. I mean, people, you know, a lot of laws went out early on that were, you know, kind of silly, right? Like in New York, they outlawed the word saloon back, I think it was the 30s, and some guy had a bar called O'Malley's Saloon, and so he got mad and just changed it to O'Malley's Balloon.
Oh. You know?
I don't think that stopped anybody from drinking.
Right. I mentioned off the top just the growing number of breweries here in California, by far the leading state, not per capita, but in volume of breweries out there. What is it that California does on the regulation side of the industry that sets it apart from the other 49?
Yeah, so we mentioned self-distribution. I think that's huge. The other thing that we allow that not all states allow is taproom sales. I think it's almost a majority now, or it is a majority that do allow it. But if you're making your own beer, you can have a taproom on your own premises and sell retail out of there. And so what that does is it allows direct-to-sale product to the consumer without that markup that you might otherwise have with a wholesaler. And so that is a big moneymaker. And California also allows duplicate licenses. So if you have a Type 23 license, which is basically a craft brewery, you can have up to 6 duplicate licenses, which means you can have tap rooms in other locations.
Oh.
You can't manufacture in other locations, but you can have tap rooms. So if we take Device again, I'm not picking on Canada Device, but if we take Device again, they have their brewery down off Jackson over there, and then they have their brand new tap room in the Ice Blocks, which is a super great space.
I've been there. It's terrific.
It's super cool. And what this duplicate license thing does is allow you to sell more product directly to consumers in different locations. So that's another added benefit that we have. We also have
without as much overhead. So you have the overhead of the brewery itself, and then it's much easier to sell it out of one of those tap rooms.
Yeah, and two of the duplicate licenses can be bona fide eating establishments. So you might be a brewery and you might open up a restaurant, and you know, you have that added income. So that's been really helpful. I also, you know, if you even simple things like growlers, not all states allow growler fills, and you know, we do, and I think that's very lucrative.
And a growler, for people that don't know, is like a big jug of beer. So you can go in and they literally fill it out of the tap.
They do, right. So, and that rule, you know, in the beginning, you could never use, somebody else's growler, you'd have to obliterate any kind of advertising. Now you just have to obscure the advertising if you're a brewery and you're going to fill it, and you have to put your own tag on it. But yeah, so they've loosened those kinds of laws. We can sell at farmers markets if you get the right kind of permits, $110, I think. So farmers market sales, that kind of thing. And, you know, most other states don't go that far. And I'd say that California is the most craft brewery friendly climate, even though there's probably craft breweries out there that are saying this guy's crazy because the laws are so darn restrictive.
That on-site sale of beer is really a big deal for people who like the super fresh, mm-hmm. like Northeastern style mm-hmm. of IPA. Mm-hmm. You know, it's canned and then you're supposed to drink it within just a few days. If it has to go through a distributor and how many, you know, however many steps it takes to get to the store, to be able to buy it right there in the tap room the day it was canned is a big deal for a lot of people.
I agree. And I think any kind of hoppy beer is going to be that way. I mean, you really want to drink that as fresh as possible. And, you know, I think that's actually kind of a trend that we're seeing. It's not just a trend. I think it's long term. You're seeing this movement towards local. I think the trendy word is localvores, people who mm-hmm. eat, drink, and hang out locally, spend their money locally. And I think that's going to be the trend going forward here with independent craft beer. I mean, you don't need to go to Sonoma anymore to get really, really good beer. I mean, we got a ton of great beer here in Sacramento. We have a really great beer scene, over 80 breweries at a given time. And so, you know, why do you need to go get San Diego beer when we can just get the stuff right here? And we, you know, you can know the people, you know the people at the tap room, and it's a real community kind of feel. So I think that's kind of where the craft beer scene's headed. I don't expect that people are going to be as worried about as driving 3 hours to go get some beer when you can just get it right here.
I was speaking with the head of the Craft Brewers Association, and mm-hmm. he was saying number one is San Diego, number in terms of number of breweries mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. Number two is San Francisco. Surprisingly, to some people, Sacramento falls into that number three spot, possibly right. ahead of Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of my friends and the people I know in the industry are from L.A. I'm real tight with the L.A. Brewers Guild. And when they come to Sacramento for the summit, we all went to, you know, and they were just completely, over the last 2 years or so, shocked about the beer scene we got going up here. We're making world-class beer from a variety of different breweries, and the scene's great. The food's great. You know, the people here in Sacramento are great. So I'm just super excited to be here. I think I really feel like pretty much the luckiest guy on the planet that McGeorge has supported this endeavor and let me teach this class. And Dean Schwartz and Dean Moylan have had the foresight to let me run with it, and it's been wonderful.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about the course here coming up in just a second. Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things I like about the local craft beer scene here is it seems like there's a lot of camaraderie among the different brewers that may outweigh the competition.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, maybe it's gotten a little tighter over the last few years, but the brewers themselves are the best clients you could ever have.
Yeah.
And they're friends, and they're super cool people. And you know, if a brewery down the road needs some particular hops for a certain brew, they would call their buddy down the street and say, hey, you got any of these? Can we borrow them? And more times than not, they would let them borrow those hops. It's that kind of environment. And it's definitely getting a little tighter, but everybody's generally really cool people. And it's just a great spot to be.
You're listening to Professor Dan Kroxall. He teaches a class at McGeorge School of Law on how craft beer is regulated. So, Dan, tell me, why do students sign up for your class? Are they all aspiring beer makers or lawyers?
That's a really good question. I think some of them are diehard craft beer folks, and they're like, oh my God, craft beer law, I'll take that. Some of them are like, what is this? I don't understand it, right? And it's a little bit of a sucker punch because it's a cool subject matter, and it's actually kind of a regulatory nightmare as well, so it's a bit challenging. But the response has been wonderful. I think the number was 2 minutes. The first class we offered filled up in like 2 minutes, and the waiting list was really long. And a couple of students have really run with it. I mean, there's a guy named Eric Kodog who he's a senior at McGeorge, and he has started and runs the Craft Beer Law Society. You know, and he's really getting out there and doing his thing. I have a great research assistant named Paige Davidson who has really dove in with me on these really more complex issues and helped me on publishing and the class. And it's kind of funny because she doesn't even drink, but I use her to kind of check my bias towards independent beer.
Right. How many of the laws can be easily transferred to those who make wine? We're a big wine growing region as well. Is a lot of it duplicated?
There's a fair amount, but the laws are actually, you know, over time they've been amended differently. So the wine lobby has been big and strong for a long time. And so, you know, over the years, they have been able to carve out some different kinds of benefits for their industry. And I think craft beer is slowly catching up. And it's different for craft distilleries now. I mean, distilleries are a whole different ballgame. So
yeah, there spirits are a completely different world, right?
Right. They're still regulated in California under the ABC Act. But I think that there's some striations in the statute where wineries can do some things, you know, mail order, et cetera. Breweries can't yet. But we're catching up. And I think the legislature is generally pretty supportive. You know, the regs are the regs. They're complicated and they are quite restrictive. But it's better to be here than, say, you know, I'm not picking on a state, but in Nevada, they don't allow self-distribution and things like that. They don't allow direct sales and tap rooms. So as far as a regulatory climate goes, we're in a pretty good spot here in California.
How did you get to this point? Is it because of your brother's brewery in El Segundo?
Absolutely. I totally lucked into it because of him. I was a litigator at the world's largest law firm, and he was opening a brewery in L.A., and he called and said, this is a nightmare regulatory stuff. Can you help me out? And I'm like, right. I guess. So I helped him out, and then his friend started calling, so I left the firm, opened my own. I was representing craft breweries, and this job opened up, and you know, law professor jobs are really, really hard to get. I thought I'd just throw my hat in the ring, and I was hired as a legal writing professor, which is still something, you know, my primary job at McGeorge, but they've really been helpful in sponsoring the class and helping me get out there, and it's really starting to take off. It's kind of unbelievable. I'm sitting here with you.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. I'm sort of the de facto beer reporter here at Cap Radio because of my background, I think. And last week, I did a story on a brewery out of Sonoma County that uses reclaimed water or recycled water they use for, like, washing down their brew house. It's a very water-intensive industry. Mm-hmm. They used it to brew a pilsner that I tasted, and it tasted terrific. Mm-hmm. Currently, they aren't selling the beer and tell me it's a regulatory gray area, both statewide and federally. Do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, that's more of a probably food and drug type question, which I haven't had much experience with. So I don't know. I don't know what the regs would be on that. I could find them, but yeah, that's definitely not my area of expertise.
But the beer regulators do get very picky about what you add to your beer.
So
this is a version of water, which would be one of the standard ingredients. Mm-hmm. But when you get outside the standard ingredients, then they start getting picky. And that includes like CBD, which is a derivative of cannabis.
Right. And so that raises, you know, we have the California Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. That raises a federal issue. It's the TTB, the Alcohol Tobacco Tax Trade Bureau. And they maintain a list of things that you can add to your beer without seeking a formula approval. And if you want to add anything else, you need to seek a formula approval from the TTB. And I think, you know, as long as this administration is in charge, that anything kind of marijuana related is probably going to be off limits on a federal level. So that would directly affect their ability to make it in the states as well. So, yeah, there's also an adjuncts list, which is kind of chemicals that you can and can't add. So you have ingredients like fruit, and they have a long list of what you can add without seeking approval. They also have a chemical list of things like lipase and all kinds of chemicals that you can add without seeking approval. But if you want to add anything other than that, you have to get there okay. And I just don't see it happening with marijuana-based ingredients.
How much do you drill down into local rules? You know, you've got federal and then state and then cities like Sacramento, for instance, has a no singles rule.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that changes from place to place. And I think that really becomes important when you're trying to get a brewery open. And at that point, you really need to dive into local ordinances and figure out what's happening and what their ordinance scheme is. I don't really deal with it unless I have a client who's trying to open, you know, and they can be very different. The times when you can sell alcohol, when you have to close, all that kind of stuff. Can be very different from location to location, as well as the planning department, right? The local health department, all these different departments, you really have to be able to navigate through those waters and make sure that you're doing what one department says you have to at the same time doing what another department says you have to. So it can be pretty complex.
So you're driving along right now listening to Cap Radio on your way into work, and you have this great batch of homebrew at home, and everyone tells you that your homebrew is the best. You should open your own brewery. Do you have to have an attorney at this point, or can you manage this without one?
You know, craft brewers tend to be independent types. I think a lot do get open without an attorney. I think it's wise to use one to make sure that you're not stepping in a big pile of leaves. I think it's wise to use one, but money's always tight when you're opening. But I am seeing more and more breweries with investor-backed money. And, you know, if you're planning on growing, you know, up to the 5,000-barrel range, you should probably get started, right? You know, the vast majority of breweries are under 1,000 barrels a year. A lot of those guys probably won't hire counsel right away. But they will end up hiring counsel if they get some kind of suspension or they have a violation or things like that. So, you know, it's funny. The craft beer world was originally a little bit reticent about lawyers, right? And one time I showed up at a brewery event, or a CCBA event, actually, dressed basically like I am now in a dress shirt. And people were looking at me like, who are you? Right? So for the rest of them, I'd wear a beer shirt and jeans, you know? Uh-huh. It's a pretty exclusive group. You can't just hang up a shingle and say, I'm a craft brew lawyer. If it wasn't for my brother, there's no way I would have fallen into this. So I'm super grateful to him, and he's been very supportive as well.
In terms of production size, do the laws change the bigger you get?
So that's actually really interesting. In California, I talked about self-distribution. Other states have kind of a mid-level where you can self-distribute basically up to, I think North Carolina, for example, is 25,000 barrels. If you're a brewery producing that much, you have to go through a distributor.
What would be an example of that size brewery? Like Sierra Nevada is way beyond that.
Oh, man, yeah. Sierra Nevada is, I'm going to guess, 3 million, but that's a guess. I think so. Modern Times, you know, Modern Times.
Yeah.
I just saw. I think this morning they're on pace to hit 65,000, which is ridiculously huge.
What's Track 7 at right now?
I would guess Track 7's between 5,000 and 9,000 barrels, somewhere around there. So when you're talking about millions of, that's an unholy amount of beer. I mean, it's crazy. you know, good successful breweries that we consider in our area, like you know, our Devices, our Track 7s, our Bike Dogs, are probably between, you know, 3 to the top 10,000. Mm-hmm. So it's not...
So they would still be in the lower tier for other states?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, but nationwide, most breweries brew under 1,000 barrels a year. I think the number is like 70 to 80%.
And that's what keeps them craft. Or as we said at the top of the show,
right.
You and I would like the term to switch back to microbrewery.
Right.
Because everyone has grabbed onto that craft term.
That's correct.
And it's been watered down, which you never want to water down your beer.
Yeah, I that's right. That's funny. I think that the word craft is pretty much dead. I think the word to key in on is independent. The Brewers Association is pushing that really hard. You know, a lot of people do care about who makes their beer, right?
And so would they change their name to the Independent Brewers? Because right now they're the Craft Brewers Association.
I think it's going to stick. But when I'm talking with, you know, people in the industry, the term craft just has been stolen, essentially. I mean, there are giant corporate breweries that now have purchased a bunch of former craft breweries. And so, they have their own, quote, craft beer. Like one of my favorite things to do is when I go to the grocery store and I see the craft beer sign, I take a picture and I'll ask my students sometimes, I'll be like, how many of these are independently owned, right? And sometimes it's 30%, sometimes it's 70%, you know, but it's really funny.
How many of these are AB InBev, which is the giant of them all?
They are the biggest, yes.
Mm-hmm. Professor Dan Kroxall from McGeorge School of Law, he teaches a class on the legal side of craft brewing and he teaches in the Global Lawyering Skills Program. And it was an absolute pleasure to have you here, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being on Insight. We'll have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Cap Radio.